Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 5th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. We're also pleased to be joined by Fran McIntyre, who's a lawyer here in Massachusetts, knows more than the average schmo about law and the legal profession, and it also happens to be a principal of a podcast called Sisters of Resistance. You can get it on Stitcher. How you doing, Fran?
I'm just fine. Thanks for having me.
Good. So let me just set this up. And DR, I'll ask you to tell us what the recent development is. But, about a year ago now, a company called Energy Transfer Partners was trying to build a pipeline called the Dakota Access Pipeline down through a long history, but it basically was routed to cross the Missouri River, which near the edge of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Because of various unfairnesses and inequities in the whole thing, we don't need to go into, the Standing Rock Sioux started to put up a camp, literally a camp of yurts and tents and stuff, overlooking the construction site and essentially blocking the construction site. And that went on for a year, through last December. We should note that the, just to put a topper on it all, the Dakota Access Pipeline started flowing gasoline, to the fuel today, so it's working. But that camp on the plains of the Dakota Plains there grew and grew and grew and was the site of attacks by dogs, security forces with dogs attacking protesters sometime in September. There was a horrific incident on a bridge where basically they were water cannoning the people on the bridge, and they actually threw in a stun grenade and blew off a young woman's arm who had been working there. I think she even has a Massachusetts connection, but, you know, serious damage. And but the camp continued to grow and grew and grew up to the election. In fact, through December, is dispersed now because the pipeline is running and our new president has allowed it all to go forward. But tell me, Dia, given that backdrop, that there was a large encampment of Native Americans peacefully protesting this pipeline that was there for, the camp was there for months and months, tell me what happened, what we found out recently.
Well, it was reported in The Intercept that a private security firm that was retained by Energy Transfer Partners to provide security for the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline engaged in what Grist calls, quote, intrusive military-style surveillance and counterintelligence against the activists and their allies, targeting everyone from Native American demonstrators to the actress Shailene Woodley, along with organizations including Black Lives Matter, 350.org, Veterans for Peace, the Catholic Worker Movement, and Food and Water Watch. The documents label the protesters are jihadis and basically uses this sort of military-style language, basically describing them as some sort of, enemy threat that had to be resisted. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show you this sort of profoundly weird mentality on the part of the organization known as Tiger Swan, which basically,
Tiger Swan being this group of sort of make-believe, well, maybe not so make-believe, but espionage agents checking out the encampment, right?
Exactly. It's like this sort of it's almost indescribably bizarre the actions that Tiger Swan was up to. I mean, if this was a movie plot, it would be dismissed for being so over the top and being so absurd. But yet, it was reality, and to realize the level of harassment and surveillance
I guess this is the sort of stuff
that would make. It would make J. Edgar Hoover jealous what this group was doing.
Well, because there's such a rich information environment, right? I mean, they were in there on the Facebook pages of the different groups. In fact, not just at Standing Rock, but they were in Chicago and around the country. They were then sort of checking out the activities of other people, and it's just it's I guess it's, as you say, it's a crossing of a line between legal investigation and, you know, private data collection, which I guess doesn't have the same kind of rules. Well, Fran, let me ask you, between, you know, what can a private company do to investigate you versus what a law enforcement agency can do? I mean, do they follow the same rules in terms of probable cause and whatnot?
Well, no, a private agent isn't obligated to follow the Constitution unless they have been directly engaged by a law enforcement agency. If they're directly engaged, then they are agents of the law enforcement agency, and they would be held to the same standard. So I would say that they would be controlled only by the statutory and regulatory scheme. I understood that some of this was not simply viewing publicly available information on the internet, but that some of it was actually hacking into people's private computers and email, and behaviors that one would expect would be a violation of the law. But to tell you the truth, it's all very technical, and I'm not exactly sure. It would seem to me that some of those protested would certainly have a right of privacy that had been violated, but whether they could ever have the resources to actually vindicate that, to secure counsel and actually go after an outfit like this. Think of the discovery, and by that I mean the investigation, the forensic investigation to find out who Tiger Swan was. It sounds like, doesn't it, DR, that they were former military people who
were employing
military tactics in a civilian situation, and in this case representing economic interests. It's very, very terrifying when you try to consider how can this be imposed, how can it be beaten back, how can it possibly be legal? What framework is it that makes it punishable? And who will punish it? Who will punish it in this environment where there are no U.S. attorneys? And what U.S. attorney would have the political motivation to want to protect the Standing Rock protesters?
Right. Against an oil company that Donald Trump owns stock in, right?
Exactly. Keeping track of the fact that federal prosecutors basically can exercise their discretion entirely as to what they choose to go forward against and what not. So I don't think you could look to any sort of enforcement on the federal side. It would have to arise out of the state side. I don't remember that you would know, Ted, the four states that the pipeline traveled through that were involved here. Mm-hmm. The attorneys general in those states could certainly undertake an investigation, and the individual citizens could certainly. But, you know, to litigate something like this takes a lot of resources and a lot of money. So private citizens whose rights have been violated are unlikely to take on something like Tiger Swan.
I guess the question is, the trend of the times, though. I mean, it is like a science fiction novel where the corporation has more and more money and the technology allows them to know more and more, and there's no realistic way to oppose it. I mean, it's not, you know, it seems like you're in some sort of a futuristic movie. Yeah, that all of a sudden you're in, because we've talked before on the show about agricultural gag laws, right, where it's illegal to take a video camera into a combined animal feedlot, right? Because they don't want you to videotape the downer cows because it's bad for the meat industry. And that's been extended, or they've tried to extend that, to preventing drones with cameras from flying over fracking sites to keep track of what's going on. So it's these public efforts in these sort of narco, what do we call it, petro states in the Midwest to prevent this kind of protest. I mean, I think that what's happened with this Tiger Swan thing is part and parcel of a lot of other bills that are floating around out there to try and suppress protests, right? What they're doing in the state of Washington, where if you break a law, sort of a direct action, then you have to pay economic damage to the city or something. Basically, it's intimidating fines they try and put on public protest.
I think what you want to bear in mind is that the protections and the civil rights that we hold are guaranteed us as against the government.
Right.
It's the government that is prevented from infringing on our constitutional and civil rights, not private industry. But the truth of it is that a properly motivated prosecutor could find grounds to go after this if they wanted to find some ground there. And so it really comes down to the motivation, which unfortunately in this administration, I think, has been largely lost.
Yeah. We need a more Healy out in.
Exactly. So it's gonna that's where it's gonna fall down into the subgroups, the states and individuals, I think, Ted.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you. But I mean, I think that we have to watch this, right? This is not a good development.
Absolutely. It just goes to show you how paranoid these groups are about protests. When people say that protests don't make a difference, if it didn't make a difference, why would they be going so far in an attempt
That's right.
to sort of suppress? You know, they're trying to resist the resistors, basically.
Absolutely. There was some quote from some 17-year-old girl in the Grist article was surprised that anyone actually cared enough to check up on her Facebook page. There you go. So, DR, tell me, speaking of large corporations that have vested interest in the oil industry, I heard there was some kerfuffle at the Exxon shareholder meeting. Tell me what happened there.
Yes, the Exxon shareholder meetings have gotten increasingly contentious over the years. And according to Think Progress, 62% of Exxon shareholders have voted in favor of a resolution requiring Exxon to report how its businesses will be affected by global efforts to reduce carbon emissions. This occurred just around the time of Trump yanking the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which Exxon called upon Trump to stay in. Mm-hmm. And it basically goes to show you the power of shareholder activism. It has been increasing in recent years. There have been a number of pushes to have Exxon demonstrate more responsibility on climate. And this is a big and shocking thing.
Right, you say, just to repeat it, you said 62% of the shareholders at the meeting, which is it must be a lot of people, voted. And is this a non-binding thing, demanding that they post their analysis of the impact? Or is it binding?
Exactly. It's my understanding is that it's non-binding, but nevertheless, because of the amount of coverage it's received, and because of the whole Exxon New movement, it's very, very interesting to see even shareholders want some accountability from Exxon. They want them to declare once and for all how their businesses will be impacted by efforts to cut emissions and what it plans to do about it. Are there any sort of plans to sort of, invest more and more in clean energy? We see all these Exxon Mobil commercials about, algae we're spending billions investing in biofuels and renewable energy. Well, I think a lot of people want some evidence, want some proof to see if Exxon is preparing for a post-carbon future.
Does that infuriate you as much as it does me, DR and Fran? I mean, the sort of twangy banjo song where the people are making algae fuel, and the green water trickling away, as if that is anything more than a cosmetic, chump change for Exxon, right, to fund this little thing and then have a big commercial about it. Yeah, I know you've ranted and raved about this, and all the gasoline and oil, and natural gas commercials you see on MSNBC. It's just,
I think part of the reason why Exxon gets a pass on this is because of the fact that former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson and the current ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods both proclaim support for a carbon tax. So I think a lot of people but there's a certain mentality in the country that's inclined to give them a pass on their past actions because they're now saying, hey, we're responsible. We're not like Trump. We're not calling it a hoax anymore, that sort of thing, even though they funded, to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars, people who said it was, in fact, a hoax.
Yeah. I mean, I would believe them much more if they put a single lobbyist in a Congress asking for a carbon tax, right? But, I mean, it's happy talk, but then they don't do anything. I don't know. I'm outraged. Well, I guess, you got anything else, DR? What should we enlighten our audience about now?
How about that Juliana case? The Juliana case.
So, DR, set up the Juliana case. Tell me what that was about.
Well, as we've discussed before, and obviously I've discussed also my cynicism about the ultimate outcome of this case, but a group of a group of young adults have sued the United States government in federal court, arguing that the federal government is violating its right to a stable atmosphere by not doing anything to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Three fossil fuel industry groups attempted to intervene in the lawsuit because they were skeptical about the United States government putting up a strong defense, and now they want out of that lawsuit. The American Petroleum Institute, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers have moved to get out of the lawsuit. They no longer want to intervene.
Well, let me just keep up. So the kids bring a lawsuit saying that the government has a responsibility to take care of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And then these three companies, these three oil groups, decide they're going to oppose the lawsuit because they think the feds aren't going to do it strongly enough?
Yes. Yeah, they believe that the federal government would not mount a strong enough defense for its perceived inaction.
But can those three companies volunteer? I mean, to sort of take over the defense of the prosecution of the idea? I'm just confused.
My understanding is that they were effectively attempting to join, essentially as defendants, if you will, to sort of push back against this. But now they don't want to be associated with the lawsuit anymore.
Forgive me, Dio. So these three companies are saying we want to stand beside the federal government and be on their side. We three plus Uncle Sam are all together. Sue all of us together, and now they want. Got it.
So can I jump in here?
Yeah,
Ted?
Please, sure. Go right ahead.
Because I think DR calls it right when he says that these three groups, which just I think the names of them are interesting. The American Petroleum Institute. So who do you suppose is in that? The American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. So who do you suppose is in that? And the National Association of Manufacturers. But anyway, he says he thinks that they were skeptical that the federal government would appropriately defend. Now, remember, at the time when this motion to intervene, that's the motion, that's what they're looking to join into the lawsuit, to become parties in the lawsuit, to actually get a chance to litigate it. It was brought during 2016, during the Obama administration, when it was entirely unclear who would win the next election.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so they were at that time skeptical about how likely the U.S. government was to really defend against our Children's Trust lawsuit. And the way it looked to me, DR, as well, is that these fossil fuel groups wanted to be able to present expert testimony. They wanted to present their own expert testimony to the court. So they moved in 2016 to intervene. They were allowed into the case in November 16th of 2016, in other words, right after the election. So now they're in there as full parties defendant. And when you get involved in a lawsuit, then you're involved in discovery. And the other, you make yourself vulnerable to the other part, the plaintiff in this case, the Our Children's Trust Group, the lead name of which is Juliana, which is why it's referred to as the Juliana case, starts to go after discovery and starts looking for documents from these groups and for just huge downloading of information about their communications, and then particularly seeks a discovery procedure that's referred to as a request for admissions, or RFAs. And litigators and the rules of civil procedure permit one party to present the other party with a list of statements. They're not trick questions exactly, but they're factual questions, and the other party is obligated to either admit or deny those statements, or offer some explanation of privilege or some reason why they can't answer them. But as you can expect, between lawyers, it's an effort to pin the other party down to certain points of view. And
which is just right. Let me just say, so this is the Juliana people that are saying that the kids are going to ask a bunch of questions of these three companies and try and box them in and make them admit stuff. Okay. Yeah. Correct.
And it's not really questions, it's actually statements of fact. And then the fossil fuel companies are obligated to admit or deny, as well as the U.S. government, and to take actual positions, it appeared to me, on climate change science and climate change issues. Now, interestingly, the plaintiffs had sent those requests for admissions to the defendants. The rules would have provided for a certain amount of time for the defendants to respond. The defendants sought more time, and the judge gave them more time. That deadline was May 25th of 2017. And so the judge also ordered that their answers would have to be posted electronically and therefore available publicly. And so I think that's when they began to get kind of squirrely about having to answer this discovery, to provide this discovery, and they realized that somewhere in the midst of all this, there had been a motion to dismiss that had been brought and denied. And so they weren't going to get
who?
Out of it.
By who? The feds?
By the defendants. By the defendants. Right. The feds and the petrochemical people had all sought a motion to dismiss. So they probably thought there was going to be an easy win there. When that didn't fly, then they became vulnerable to discovery. And so as of May 25th, these three organizations filed motions to withdraw. In other words, they'd fought hard to become involved in the case, and now they were seeking to withdraw. Mm-hmm. Now, they did not provide anything other than boilerplate language, which essentially said, we got in, so that means we can get out,
right,
and we won't cause any prejudice, and it'll actually take less time if we can get out. They were permitted to get out. But in a little tiny footnote, it said in the actual pleading that the plaintiffs have agreed that the defendants will not have to answer the request for admissions if they move to withdraw by May 25th, the deadline for answering the request for admissions. So it appears clearly, you can see that rather than answer the request for admissions, these three fossil fuel organizations have sought to withdraw and get out of the lawsuit rather than face the exposure of discovery.
And even just by making the request, and they've satisfied the rule of the law, the rule of the specifics there. So if it's denied that they can withdraw, if the judge says you can't withdraw, you have to stay in, then they still don't have to answer the questions? Is that
No. If the judge doesn't allow them to get out, they will have to answer, and there'll probably be like a 10-day time frame that they have on it. But the plaintiffs do not appear to be objecting vociferously. In fact, they hadn't stated any objection to the parties when they had conferred before this had been filed. And so it wouldn't strike me as unlikely that the judge would let these companies out now.
Really?
And because he probably would have an interest in judicial economy, in reducing the number of parties, in reducing the length of litigation. So we'll see what happens. Wow. The new parties that came in alleged that as of right, they ought to be able to withdraw. The judge can decide otherwise.
Uh-huh.
And at least as of last night, the plaintiffs had not filed any opposition to these motions. But it clearly was an effort to avoid having to make the discovery, to answer questions and get pinned down.
How unusual is that? I mean, in these kind of cases, do people sort of get in and get out?
I would say it's relatively unusual, but it's also the leverage of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
People try to take aim at each other and put pressure on each other and hope that they're going to get somebody to take an action, you know. And so it's easier for the plaintiffs to deal with the United States government than it was with three different organizations.
The plaintiffs, again,
the
being
States,
the kids, the
children,
the children.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So I think that DR is right, that the defendants that just came in were skeptical of the United States government willingness to defend back in the Obama days, and when they thought it was going to be Hillary Clinton taking over this lawsuit.
Right.
Now they're not so worried about it anymore, because it's Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt that are at the top of this defense is going to. Well, they're not going to be at the top of the defense. It's Jeff Sessions, because the Department of Justice is the one that's doing the defending here. But they don't. Again, you know, the action of withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, I just think takes all the motivation and all the psychological heft out of any effort at enforcement. Not any effort, but of a considerable amount of effort.
Well,
it disembowels the effort. Let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, I guess I hadn't appreciated that level of sophistication. So that's an interesting question we'll have to follow going forward, right? I mean, it's a interesting game of chess being played out in a federal courtroom.
That is exactly what it is. It's sort of like a game of chess. So, well, you know, we'll keep track of it and see what happens with it, Ted, because we can look right at the paperwork.
Well, there you go. We will, whenever that comes up, we're going to put it on the blog, and we'll try and put in a few tidbits from this this discussion at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us, of course, you can find the podcast on Facebook. It's @massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends. The more people that hear about us, the better I like to think they're better for the planet, but there you go. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, lots of other directories. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, Fran, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Ted.
Dr., thank you for being here.
Thanks.
And everyone, take care. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.